Hey, hey, have you heard? It's your host, Chris DeMakes, and I'm headed back to the Punk Rock Museum. That's right, the powers that be have invited me back, and I couldn't be more excited. Allow me to be your guide as we wind through 5 decades of punk rock history, merchandise, and memorabilia. Cinco de Mayo weekend, Friday, May 3rd, Saturday, May 4th, and Sunday, May 5th. There'll be 2 tours each day at 12:30 p.m. and 4 p.m. And the best part for me is you. Your stories, your questions, your experiences. Yep, some of you old punkers have taught this guy a thing or two on these tours, and I love it. Head over to thepunkrockmuseum.com for tickets. Don't miss out. Only 30 spots per tour. Get your tickets now at thepunkrockmuseum.com.
Blacking in and out in a strange flat in East London. Somebody I don't really know just gave me something to help settle me down and to stop me from always thinking about you. And you know your life is heading in a questionable direction.
Hey, music fans, we got a good one lined up for you. Today's guest is singer-songwriter Frank Turner from Meon Stoke, Hampshire, England. And we break down his 2013 hit Recovery from the album Tape Deck Heart. Frank takes us through a play-by-play behind the song's inspiration and how it was called from a very dark moment in his life. We talk about some of his favorite singer-songwriters whose storytelling have influenced Frank's own work. He shares a really cool story of being on tour for months on end in America, only to return home to England and find that Recovery, unbeknownst to him, roaring up the English radio charts. And who knew that Frank dabbled in botany and has a bit of a green thumb? Prior to this, I didn't. For all this and a whole lot more, stick around for some fun.
Hey, hey, have you heard? Chris DeMakes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Chris DeMakes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Chris DeMakes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Chris DeMakes a podcast.
Frank hails from Meon Stoke, which I had the correct pronunciation the first time before we started rolling here.
You nailed it.
And that's in Hampshire, England. And, you know, Frank, I had heard, you know, because Less Than Jake's done a ton of touring, as you know, over in the UK.
Yeah,
it's like our home away from home. I had certainly heard of your post-hardcore band Million Dead, but I didn't realize you were in it until I started researching for this episode. And I went back and Million Dead wasn't a small band. I mean, you guys were out there, you know.
Thank you. I mean, Million Dead, I'm fiercely proud of Million Dead. We got to a point, I think we once played to 800 people at a headline show. And we kind of thought we were the Clash at that point, I'm pretty sure. But we never really toured outside the UK. We did a handful of shows in Europe and we did a couple of showcases in the States. But it's a shame to me looking back that we didn't really know how to tour outside the UK. And having now done it, it's not the hardest thing to get going. And I wish we'd done more of that, but the band didn't last that long. So it's a shame, but thank you.
Well, no, I went back. I saw you guys had done some festivals, and you definitely had had your pockets of fans. And there's many bands that would have given their left leg to do what you guys accomplished.
Well,
you know,
that's true.
The band split up in 2005, and you know, I had read online, and I want to get this actual actually from you that around this time you had heard Springsteen's Nebraska, and it kind of singer songwriter kind of changed your thinking of where you wanted to go career-wise?
Yeah, I mean, that's a kind of very condensed version of the story that seems to have taken root on the internet in various places. And it's not untrue, but it wasn't just that record. It was a whole selection of stuff. I was playing in a kind of hardcore band. I was touring with other hardcore bands. And you reach a point where you can't then listen to hardcore when you're lying in your bunk at the end of the night on the tour bus or whatever, because you'd lose your mind, or at least I would. You know, I was banging to the first Counting Crows record when I was a kid, and Weezer and stuff like that, but had then gone down the rabbit hole of being obsessed with hardcore, basically. I started branching out my listening, and there was a few things that I stumbled across, and Springsteen Nebraska is one of them. Prior to that, my knowledge of Springsteen was that he was the guy in the white t-shirt and the blue jeans singing about America, and it didn't grab me. in any way. And I wasn't really aware of the depth to his career at all.
Sure.
My parents weren't really into any kind of modern music, so my entire knowledge of modern music was sort of self-created. The first band I fell in love with was Iron Maiden. I had this. By the time I reached my early 20s, I could have literally listed you every single Sick of It All record in order, and I couldn't. I don't think I'd ever heard a Bob Dylan song. What I mean? So I had this kind of weird topsy-turvy thing anyway. So I got into kind of early Dylan. I got into Springsteen, Nebraska. The Johnny Cash American recording series was quite a useful gateway for me because he covered stuff like Nine Inch Nails and Soundgarden and that kind of thing. So that was a way of listening into that world. And I guess the thing is, for me, and to pick an example from Nebraska, like a song like State Trooper. State Trooper is heavy as fuck. Do you know what I mean? And like, it's heavy in a way that doesn't involve taking your shirt off and screaming at the front row and having a shaved head and tattoos and kind of sweat and testosterone. It's heavy in a very different way. It's emotionally heavy. That was a big reveal to me in my early 20s. And when Million Dead broke up, the other thing that had happened, of course, is that the band didn't end particularly well. It was a very long time ago now, so I can talk about it with a degree of detachment. But at the time, I felt pretty burned by the whole thing. And I sort of felt like I wanted to do something different. I didn't want to just do another hardcore band. I didn't want to be in a band full stop at the time because I felt like, again, I'm old enough now to kind of see that it was more nuanced than this, but at the time I felt like I'd been let down by other people with the band breaking up. And it was like, what can I do that's just me under my own steam? I don't have to depend on other people, that's going to be different. Oh, I had an acoustic guitar. I used to play acoustic guitar on beach holidays with my sister and sing Weezer songs and Counting Crows songs and stuff like that. Soul Asylum, quite a lot of Soul Asylum, that sort of thing. I think before Million Dead broke up, I'd done a handful of kind of like, I did like a benefit show at one time. Somebody asked me to play and the whole band couldn't play, so I did a solo set. And I kind of enjoyed it. And it was, I just thought I'd give it a shot. It was interesting. Everyone thought I'd lost my mind at the time. As you and I both know, the pathway of kind of being in a punk band, then making an acoustic record is reasonably well established these days. Back in 2005, pretty much the only people who'd done that were Chuck Reagan and Tim Barry.
Sure.
And it was like, when I told my friends, and indeed like the sort of the music industry people who I knew who'd worked with Million Dead, that I was now going to go and make solo acoustic folk music, people genuinely thought I'd gone crazy. They were just like, what the fuck is wrong with you?
I'm going to tell you the reason I brought it up, where you came from and how you did this change. A lot of hardcore singers, you know, they're kind of one-trick ponies. They scream and they scream and that's their
Man,
thing.
I'm on tenterhooks for Rick to Life solo acoustic record. I can't wait. It's gonna be incredible.
But it just shows the depth of you as an artist, and I mean that with sincerity.
Well,
and I just want to say something real quick, and we're gonna dive into the song. Frank and I are gonna break down Recovery today. You know, my producer Chris was recently asked, I believe it was in our Facebook group, you know, does Chris, meaning me, does he really love, he says he loves all these songs that he analyzes, you know, and I'm, I don't know, 40 episodes deep or something now in this podcast. And I truly do. I do love every song, not equally. And some of the songs I haven't, some of the songs I didn't even really like or love coming into it. But when I get into the psyche of the artist and we start breaking it down and I learn the inspiration of the song, I have grown to love them all in their own right.
Sure.
But I gotta say, this song, just the first time I ever heard it, it was goosebumps. I love this song, Frank. And I don't recall if you remember meeting me. Probably not, because I was introduced to you through Fat Mike backstage at a festival probably 7 years ago. And
In which case, all bets are off. Do you know what I mean? I think that there is a legal clause somewhere that if your way of knowing someone is Fat Mike, then you're not like liable for any anything ever. I do remember meeting you because I know Vinny as well, right? So
I remember being, for lack of a better word, a little starstruck because I had already heard this song. And this song to me is just, I love it. So getting into this one, I have so much to talk about. This particular tune, the record that you had done, the previous album was England, Keep My Bones. And that came out in June of 2011. And then, of course, Recovery is on Tape Deck Heart that was released in April of 2013. Was yeah. this song written specifically for Tape Deck Heart? Is it something you had lying around, and just kind of how did it happen?
Generally speaking, I don't do masses in the way of kind of like allocating songs to different stockpiles. Generally speaking, I just kind of write and then look at what I've got, and it becomes a record. And what the theme and the feel of the record is dictated by what the material is. You know what I mean? There's mm-hmm. been exceptions to that. I did a history record called No Man's Land, and obviously the songs for that were quite specific, so they went over there. But with this one, I finished In Can Keep My Bones. In Can Keep My Bones was kind of a breakthrough record for me in many ways. Internationally, it was a record. It was my first gold record. It was the first time I ever headlined an arena show in 2012, which was big news. And at that point, I signed a deal to license my music to major labels. I remained signed to XMR Recordings, but we worked through some majors internationally. And it was just this moment of kind of like arrival, I want to say.
Yeah.
And the thing was, I mean, I try not to be too directed in my writing. I don't want to like plan what to write about and then write about. I like to just kind of let it come and then go, oh, that was interesting after the event. But the one thing I would say is that like In Keep My Bones was quite bombastically themed. It was about death and it was about national identity. And that's quite sort of grandiose in its way. And at this moment in time when that had blown up and suddenly there was this much, much bigger audience interested in what I was doing, it struck me that it would be interesting to go in a different direction, sort of in terms of scale of ambition and scope and subject matter at that precise moment, and not to try and write an even more grandiose record, but to do the opposite and to go inwards, you know, and to try and write something really, really small and personal and intense. And that was, of course, aided by the fact that I would gone through, and all of this is related, I'd gone through a pretty kind of unpleasant breakup at around that period of time. I had a long-term partner. I'm not sure that we were destined to spend the rest of our lives together anyway, but nevertheless, the fact of things becoming much more successful for me did no favors for our relationship in a way that I'm sure you can know what I'm talking about.
You'd think it would, but it doesn't.
Right. And then the final part of that puzzle is that like there's a lot of great breakup records in the world, right? The one that immediately springs to mind for me would be August and Everything After by The Crows, but mm-hmm. almost all of them are written from the point of view of the victim. You know what I mean? It's like, I am suffering. Someone has done me wrong. My life is awful because yes. I got dumped, kind of thing. And that's a rich scene for songwriting, let's be honest. It's because it's a very emotional experience. But at the same time, it struck me that there's not that many breakup records written from the point of view of the perpetrator. Do you know what I mean? And it was like, and I was the perpetrator in this situation. And I fucked it up. I fucked it up profoundly. And it was my fault. And I did a lot of things that I'm not proud of and ended up hurting somebody I cared about and in this really, really shitty situation that was entirely self-created. And I started writing about that stuff anyway because that's what was happening to me emotionally at the time, and my emotional experiences tend to end up in songs. But I just thought it'd be kind of interesting. What if there was a breakup record that was written by the bad guy? And that was kind of where my head was at, was like, let's do something that's like, and I had this idea of like, let's make this record as intense and personal and as unforgiving to myself as I possibly can. You know, yeah. There's a song on the record called Plain Sailing Weather, and it's like, give me one fine day of plain sailing weather, I can fuck up anything. And that's an entire song about being an asshole. And it's a very strange experience to have people sing that song back at me live, because I'm like, are you agreeing or are you sympathizing? Because, do you know what I mean? There's different things going on here. But yeah, so it was that was the kind of general kind of emotional milieu that I was in. I was trying to write about that kind of stuff. And I think from memory that Recovery was one of the first songs that I finished for the record. And like a lot of my songs, the initial sparking off point was a kind of a snapshot image or experience, which was very real, which is that not long after we'd broken up. I feel like this is long enough now that there I go that I can be completely true in this, truthful in this story.
Let's hear it.
I ended up going to a birthday party of a model, right? In a warehouse in fashionable East London.
You which cheeky is like twat.
Well, the thing is, that is not a kind of social environment in which I'd ever really been before or since, because it's really not the kind of shit that I do. But I was recently single. I was recently successful, and it was, I got an invite, and I thought, fuck it, let's go. And I ended up over there, and at the time there was this new drug doing the rounds called methadrone, which was a kind of plant food, but it was basically like very, very cheap coke, and which which put you in a really emotionally weird situation when you were coming down as well. I once took some and then in the following morning watched Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves and burst into tears when the king arrives at the end and it's Sean Connery.
I will not allow this wedding to proceed.
My lord.
Unless I am allowed to give the bride away. You look radiant, cousin.
No. So it's a strange experience. And but anyway, I'd been at this party at this model's house and it had all been very fucked up. And like, I was really uncomfortable. I don't like that sort of scene. I've never really been cool. I didn't want to become cool. And I was obviously not in a particularly settled emotional place. And I did that classic thing of making a phone call towards the end of the night / beginning of the morning to my recent ex to kind of go, oh, I fucked it all up. I'm a complete arsehole. And she was just like, I don't really know what you want me to say at this point, but you should let me go back to sleep, kind of vibe. And that was that's the first verse of the song, Blacking In and Out in a Strange Flat in East London.
Wow. Okay. I want to get into the lyrics here in a moment, but
yeah,
I do have to say, and sometimes I feel like I can be self-deprecating against myself on the show, and I never want to come off as that. And I don't mean it like I'm patronizing you either, but there's something about the singer-songwriters that can tell this story of imagery through the lyrics that I've always admired. I mean, you've seen it. We've been in an Irish pub and there's some bloke in the corner that's strumming with a tip jar out. Nobody knows who this guy is, but you're just immersed. You've had a couple pints, right, and you're listening to this guy tell a story and you're like, wow, this is great. And just totally. these lyrics and what you do here, I strive to be able to write a song with this kind of imagery. It just tells a story from the first lyric. I'm hooked. I'm hooked by what is going on here. And now that I'm hearing the story, it's even becoming more interesting. And I'd like to get into this to this first verse now that you were just setting up. The song's 3 minutes and 28 seconds. And it just starts out with you and the guitar, blacking in and out in a strange flat in East London. Somebody I don't really know just gave me something to help settle me down and to stop me from always thinking about you. And the you is the person you were bothering on the phone at 4 in the morning.
Yes, exactly. And I'm not sure that it settled me down. That wouldn't necessarily be the right way of putting it. But and the song obviously goes to other places and uses other imagery and other events and all the rest of it. But like, I often find that a snapshot moment really works. I should preface what I'm about to say by saying that there is no universe in which I am or ever will compare myself to Shane McGowan. But like, you know, that I'm such a huge fan of the opening lines of a song, because that's the moment when you, as a listener, decide whether or not you're paying attention. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And you know, Christmas Eve, babe, in the drunk tank. It's like, oh, okay, I'm listening. Like,
I get it.
What the fuck? Yeah, and it's like, and similarly, I don't know if you're familiar with the band AJJ out of Phoenix, Arizona. They used to be called Andrew Jackson Jihad. They changed their name.
Yes. Yeah,
for obvious reasons. Sean from AJJ is a dear, dear friend of mine, and he's one of my very favorite writers. And what I love about him is his mastery of the opening line in a slightly different way. But I mean, a man who can write a song that opens with the line, I want to fuck the devil in his ass. It's just like, tell me more, sir. Do you know what I mean?
Where do I sign up?
Yeah, let me just make myself a cup of tea and settle down somewhere, and then we can really get into this shit, because I need to know what it is you're about to say.
Hey, this is Dewey Halpas, host of Peer Pleasure on the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. Join me each week as I explore another long-form conversation with one of your favorite musicians, actors, comedians, or creatives. From Chino Moreno of the Deftones, John Gorley of Portugal the Man, to Fat Mike from NoFX and Ian MacKay from Fugazi and Minor Threat, we go all over the map. From Fall Out Boy to Slayer, Peer Pleasure has it all. Check us out now on Sound Talent Media.
So you know, I'm it's very kind of you to say, like, I wanted to start the song with something that was would set the scene and be arresting.
I love it. And as I was researching the song, I saw you on Letterman. The performance was I would have loved to have been on David Letterman. Congratulations. That's like one of the top tier things you could ever do in the States.
You know, it is of a tier that English people know what it is. Do you know what I mean?
Of course I got down the YouTube line of festivals you had played live with this song, and just that you come out and you just strum that chord and you start singing and the whole crowd just lights up, because that line is just, it's just so great and everyone can relate.
This song's about getting better. This song's called Recovery. Blocking in and out in a strange flat in East London. Somebody I don't really know just gave me something to help settle me down, to stop me from always thinking about you. And you know your life is heading in a questionable direction when you're up for days with strangers and you can't remember anything except the way.
We get into the next half of the verse. I love how this song builds, and I want to get into Rich Costey in a bit and his production.
Oh, yeah.
What Rich brought to this, because this song just keeps building, and there's just such little pieces of ear candy that floating in and out. Just the subtle hi-hat comes in, and the lyric is, and you know your life is heading in a questionable direction when you're up for days with strangers and you can't remember anything except the way you sounded when you told me you didn't know what I should do. Those are just a continuation of where you were at with that night.
Yeah, it's a continuation. Yeah, yeah. I mean, and like, I can thankfully speak from the other end of the valley of this, but like, I had a pretty long kind of era of substance abuse in my life, and in that period of time, staying up for days was a thing that I would do quite often. You know, you go out for a night, and you go out for a Friday night, and you get home on Sunday evening, and you haven't been to bed since. And you've no idea who the people you're hanging out with in the interim were, because they were generally whoever it was who wanted to still be drinking and doing drugs at 9 o'clock in the morning, or whatever. You know what I mean? So, and it's a shitty way to live, and I speak from experience in saying that. So, up for days with strangers, like, that was the thing. It was like I would do that all the time, and in that kind of weird social and chemical situation, you quite often spill your guts to people that you don't know. And right. And I'm pretty sure at that period of time I was being pretty boring about my ex to most of the people who I encountered.
Well, and as so, you know, the more popular that you get, not that you get personally, but the more popular that people perceive you as, oh, Frank Turner's here, let's hang out, you know?
You
start hanging out at the pub at 4 in the afternoon on Friday, next thing you know, it's 9 a.m. on Sunday morning, and I get that. I love the end of this verse, because everything so far is just kind of this singer-songwriter, just this thing, and then this big snare fill comes in.
You know what I should do?
I wrote in my notes here, I just put feel good party time, because when this chorus hits, the tambourine's there, the piano's there, and it's just, it's goosebump city, man. There's just something I've always been a sucker, and it's interesting because I had read that you were a huge fan of Iron Maiden, and first record you ever owned was Killers. You talked about Maiden already.
Yeah, it's the 40th anniversary of the release of Killers today.
Nice! That's awesome.
Yeah, so there you go.
I didn't know that, but we could talk about metal in a whole other podcast. We'll save that for the future. But what I was getting at is, I'm a sucker for feel good rock and roll of any kind, and this chorus is just that. The energy of this, it just really lifts. And the chorus is, it's a long road up to recovery from here, a long way back to the light, a long road up to recovery from here, a long way to making it right.
Right. And I think this is the thing for me, like, I'm addicted to choruses, let's say that. Like, do you know what I mean? It's like, there's nothing I love in life more than just a chorus that punches you in the face.
Yeah.
And thematically, not always, every songs can be different, but like, a lot of the time for me, the purpose of a chorus, lyrically speaking, is your central statement. It's, what are you trying to say with this song? What is your purpose here? Why are you trying to make people listen to what you're saying? And, you know, that is the thing, is like, that whole scenario that I was explaining was a low point, you know, and the only good thing to be saying about hitting the bottom is that the only way is up. Do you know what I mean? And it's like, that's not to say that you automatically go up from there, but it's like, you can at the very least kind of cast your gaze in the right direction. And that was, I think, the sort of feeling I was having at that point, is it was just like, I don't want to be this. Do you know what I mean? I don't want to be this person sitting in this horrible flat doing plant food drugs and crying about my ex-girlfriend or whatever it might be. It's like, I've got to find a way of doing something else, or at least just behaving in a different way or whatever.
And you're also realizing, though, that the line is a long way to making it right. You're saying, damn, I'm in the thick of this.
Oh, yeah. Well, this goes to what we were saying about being the bad guy. It's a record about being the bad guy. It's like, I'm not down here because somebody's done this to me. I did this to myself. You know, it's entirely my fault that I'm sitting in this kind of pit of misery and despair and blah blah blah.
And that that to me is worse, because I've done that. I've been the one that messed things up, right? And then no one can beat me up as hard as I can.
Exactly. Yeah, completely. It's just like, oh, you think you, just there are days when I want to say to people, it's like, you've got a problem with me. Oh, let me tell you, I can beat you on that. Like, I am the Olympic champion of having a problem with me. But anyway, so, and it's interesting you mentioned the arrangement stuff. I mean, going to talking towards working with Rich Costey. So what was interesting about this record for me was the first time that I was like hardcore produced as an artist.
Yes.
The four records I made before this were made with friends, generally speaking. And I'm pretty forthright in my opinions about arrangement and that kind of thing. I also, you know, by this point, the Sleeping Souls, my band, were an established unit. We'd made two records together prior to this. We'd done a shit ton of rehearsals for this recording session. We'd worked out a lot of the arrangements. So I would say probably like, I'd say 50% of the arrangement ideas were mine. The next 40% were from the band. The last 10% were from Rich. But in way, it's that last 10% that makes the killer difference. Do you know what I mean? So like, for example, that you're funny that you should mention the tambourine, because Rich is obsessed with percussion in a way that I now am, having worked with him but wasn't before. I never really knew any bands that had like tambourine players or whatever when I was a kid, so I just never really thought about it. And yeah, I remember kind of jamming that chorus and it was cool and it was okay, and I was like, ah, it needs to kind of groove a bit more. And Rich was like, just you wait, sunshine. And then I'm pretty sure he made Nigel, my drummer at the time, play like 8 percussion tracks all the way through the whole thing, like shaker, two tights, tambourine, whatever the fuck, and just blending all of that in just brought it together. But like, you know, the piano riff is a beautiful thing that started as a little, just a kind of trill on the guitar that I was doing, because I tend to write the songs just vocals and guitar first and then take them to the band. And Matt, my piano player, took that little trill and turned it into a much more developed part as it currently is. Also, in traditional Matt style, he's trying to play about 18 things at the same time, so he's playing organ and piano and blah blah blah.
We all have one of those in our band.
Yeah, there was one tour where Matt's Empire of Madness, because he's got a little kind of keyboard station at the back of the stage. He suddenly turned around and it was like he had a mandolin and a guitar and a floor tom and like 3 keyboards and all this shit. It was like, dude, chill the fuck out.
Gonna need another trailer for all your shit.
Right, exactly. The Matt Nazir truck. But you know, and it, I mean, I have to say that one of the things I love about the arrangement of this song is that like it feels like us as a band firing on all cylinders. I do remember sitting around with Matt, who plays piano, and Ben, who plays electric guitar, and me with an acoustic guitar, and we played that chorus around kind of swapping parts with each other. Do you know what I mean? So like one of us playing the low chords, one of us playing the high chords, one of us playing kind of a middle part, and then it was like, cool, now, you know, pass your part to the left almost. Do you know what I mean? And just doing that for ages until we had what felt like the fullest arrangement that we could, because I want it to be a big chorus. So as it transpires, Ben's holding down the bottom end with some thick chunky electric chords, I've kind of got the middle with the acoustic stuff, and Matt's up on the top with the piano, and it feels like a well-built building.
You know, again, you talked about heavy at the top of the episode. This chorus is, it's not heavy in the sense of a hardcore or a heavy metal band, but just how big it is compared to the beginning of the track. You know, it just swells there. For the listeners, Rich Costey, he's got a great resume here. He's worked with Muse, Biffy Clyro. He mixed the Foo Fighters, Echoes, Silence, Patience, and Grace. And, you know, I wanted to bring him up because I always like to get into arrangements. And it sounds like this arrangement to this track was pretty much done when you brought it to Rich. He did that extra 10%, which I always talk about in this show. The difference between a good song and a great song is that 10%, and a lot of times it has to do with the producer. Up to this point of the through the first chorus, and we're going to get into the second verse here in a moment, up to this point, did anything change with Rich, or was this how the song was written?
I'm pretty sure that's how the song was written. I mean, Rich didn't really get into kind of like that much structure or lyrics or anything with this particular song. There were songs on the record where he did. Yeah. Actually, funnily enough, I am working with Rich on a new record right now. I mean, it's awesome. A very early days, but we're going back into that again. I mean, one of the other things as well that Rich does, and as I'm remembering working with him again now, his attention to detail as an engineer, as a recording engineer, is second to none. And it, like, in a way that is actually like kind of creepy sometimes. Do you know what I mean? you'll do a take where like 4 people are playing, and he'll stop you and he'll go, Frank, your G string is quarter of a tone sharp. And you're like,
how do you hear that?
Excuse me. And he's like, and so I go to tune it, and he goes, no, don't tune it. Just pull the string once. And he goes, do another take. And you're like, what the fuck just happened? But like, you know, he's an incredible producer. I can't say enough good things about him in terms of, you know, setting up all the tones and all the rest of it. I mean, there are parts of this song which you did definitely add to. I don't want to detract in that in any way.
I think we're going to get to that as we go, because I got a lot of notes. Okay. I think of what you're talking about, because there's so much ear candy, and I listened to this song in headphones a couple times last night, and I was just blown away by the production. We get into the second verse, and before we do this, the first chorus, the second and third chorus of the song, there's these oohs, vocal oohs going on.
Yeah.
Are they there in the first chorus, but they're mixed really, really, really low, or are they not there at all? I can't tell if they're there.
They're not there at all in the first chorus, but that, funnily enough, is very much a thing that Rich added to the song.
Okay, okay. I didn't know if they were tucked in, and we'll talk about them in a moment. The second verse here, and I've been waking in the morning just like every other day, and just like every boring blues song, I get swallowed by the pain, and so I fumble for your figure in the darkness just to make it go away. But you're not lying there any longer, and I know that. That's my fault, so I've been pounding on the floor. And I've been crawling up the walls, and I've been dipping in my darkness for serotonin boosters, cider, and some kind of smelling salts. And I'm going to have you set that up, and it's that last line is awesome. I'm going to have you set that up in a second, but I wrote here in my notes that the band comes in here. It's not heavy like the chorus, you know, but the band is. The drums are playing. It's not just acoustic guitar. The whole band's in. I notice often, and I'm wondering if this is a Rich thing, Rich Costey production. I notice it almost sounds like a hollow body, a Gretsch or something, and the left speaker doing this little counter melody on the guitar.
Waking in the morning just like every other day, and just like every boring blues song, I get swallowed by the pain, and so I fumble for your figure in the darkness just to make it go away.
But you're not lying there. Whose part was that? That's really cool.
That's Ben's part, and Ben, who plays guitar in my band, he's an amazing guy. What I love about Ben is that he thinks about guitar in a way that I totally don't. So, for example, not so much necessarily with this song, but a lot of the time what will happen is I'll demo up a song that I've written with kind of like some guitar ideas on them. And I could write a lead part for my own songs like with my eyes closed, but like Ben will write something that is just makes no sense to me the first time I hear it. And that's the strength of it, do you know what I mean? Is it's just like, I would never have come up with that. And that's why you want to be in a band with people like that, do you know what I mean? Is to broaden the palette that you're working
it's
with.
Such a it's such a cool part. I had to write it down because it just really stuck. I didn't notice it maybe the first two or three times I listened to the track, and then I really zoned in on it, and I was like, wow, that just does, it does something with what your melody's doing there. They play off of each other. It's really interesting.
What that also goes to, which we'll come to towards the end as well, we'll talk about this again, but like a big part of the music of this song is about ascent, right? About going up. And in part that is to do with, there's a guy from Austin, Texas called Comrade who makes music under the name Possessed by Paul James. And it's just completely insane, like alt-folk, alt-country stuff. I love him. He's a good friend. We toured together. And he had a song called Fathers and Sons, which it's, I'm not saying that the song is like melodically the same or anything, but like it just has this kind of like, almost like an Escher painting that just, you know, like a constant like Moebius strip kind of thing where it's just always going upwards somehow.
In the warm bath water.
And I remember jamming that song with him and thinking, that's really cool. And because of the whole lyrical drive of the chorus about long road up to recovery and all that kind of thing, I wanted the song to have this kind of feeling of ascent. So the main chords is just, you know, A, B minor, A over C sharp, and then D, and then the chorus lands on an E. So it has got this kind of ascent thing going on with it. But that guitar part is an early mention of an idea that comes in the third verse, the final verse.
The whole song just keeps doing what you're saying. It's almost like you're reading my notes back to me. This song just keeps building. Well, no, it just keeps building subtly. It's not like a huge, oh my gosh, there's this, it just keeps going up in this ascent. I love where you scream salts on smelling salts. That scream there.
I've been crawling up the walls, and I've been dipping in my darkness with serotonin boosters, cider and some kind of smelling salts.
Just that one scream launches that second chorus. And now, I don't know how many times I've heard this song, Frank, but when I sit down, and this is why I love doing this podcast, I listened to this the other night probably two or three times, and I'm like, why does the second chorus sound different than the first one? I didn't know at first. And then I zoned in on those oohs.
It just
makes the chorus. Now it's this extra part. It's subtle, but at the same time, they're not buried. Those oohs are, that's why I had to go back to the first chorus and say, are they buried there? Yeah. Are they there? I love the ooze in this chorus. And again, the lyric is, it's a long road up to recovery from here, a long way back to the light, a long road up to recovery from here, a long way to making it right. And then the band does these stops, this stop break into the beginning of the bridge. The lyric is, and on the first night we met, you said, well, darling, let's make a deal. And then just for a very short time, the only time in the song, the drums go halftime for this second line only. And it's, if anybody ever asks us, let's just tell them that we met in jail.
The first night we met, you said, well, darling, let's make a deal. If anybody ever asks us, let's just tell them that we met in jail. And that's the story that I'm sticking to like a stony face.
What a cool little turnaround there. Was that written before Rich as well?
No, yeah, very much so. I mean, I have a bit of an obsession with the bridge, right? And this goes back, and this is actually worth mentioning too at the start of the song as well. I'm an old school and enormous Nirvana fan, and a lot of people think about Nirvana and they talk about Quiet Loud, right? About the fact they'd have a quiet verse and a loud
dynamics.
Verse, and it's very effective. And that's very much what's happening at the start of this song. The other thing about Kurt Cobain as a writer, which less people talk about, to their shame, is that, in my opinion, Kurt Cobain was the absolute all-time world emperor king of the bridge, right? If you listen to most Nirvana songs, they have a great verse, they have a great chorus, and then they have another verse, they have another chorus, and it's like, cool, we're going well. And then it's like, the bridge is the bit that fucking sorts the sheep from the goats, do you know what I mean? It's just, it feels like you found the turbo inject button on a car or some shit. It's like, and you get like slammed back into your seat a little bit. If you think about a song like Francis Farmer Has a Revenge in Seattle, the bridge of that song is the reason why that song is fucking perfect, is because it suddenly goes, and it's like, oh, we're in new territory. And that's the thing. It's like, I mean, very broadly speaking, it's like first verse, you make a state, you set the scene. First chorus, you make your initial statement. Second verse, you expand on the scene. You remake your statement. Now you get to the bridge. Now you got to take this somewhere else. You got to say something else. You got to expand on the whole story. You can't just keep kind of trucking along. You've got to take it somewhere else. So this is a true story. That is, in fact, what was said to me the first time that we met. Let's just tell people we met in jail, which, let's be honest, is one hell of a fucking line. And even at the time, I remember saying to her, I'm fucking putting that in a song one day. And there
you did.
It is.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting. You know, at first I was almost saying, after the jail part, when the band kicks back in, I was like, is this a third verse? Which the third verse comes after this, because this is a bridge. It is a departure. But it still feels like you're still in story mode. It's not a departure in a sense of a bridge, like, oh, we went to a completely different thing. I love that about this bridge. And the lyric here is, and that's the story that I'm sticking to. Like a stony-faced accomplice, but tonight I need to hear some truth if I'm ever getting through this. Yeah, you once sent me a letter that said, if you're lost at sea, close your eyes and catch the tide, my dear, and only think of me. Well, darling, now I'm sinking, and I'm as lost as lost can be, and I was hoping you could drag me up from down here towards my recovery. That's awesome. That whole lost at sea. That whole lost at sea line.
Also true, incidentally, there was a moment in time when I was... that was later on in the relationship, but I was, funnily enough, I was making a music video for a song called If Ever I Stray, which is from England Keep My Bones. And the music video is me fanning about in the sea with a chair and a guitar, and it was brutally cold and an awful shitty day. I basically had to wade into the sea playing guitar about 8 times, and it sucked. And sort of in between takes, I was texting with my partner, and she sent me... she was out and about somewhere, and she got like a piece of chalk and wrote on a wall, like a kind of abandoned wall somewhere. She wrote, when you're lost at CCC, think of me, 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 and sent me a photo of this. And I was like, wow, that's cool as shit. And so, and again, that kind of, that fed into the song, that imagery.
No, it's awesome. Then we get into what I'm calling the musical bridge. And I love this part because it's only 12 seconds of relief from vocals. Because this song is, you're just getting hammered with information in a great way. But it's 12 seconds of relief that I think is needed here. I think it's great.
Oh, and it gives me a breather when we play it live. It means I can go and like sort of lean against something for a bit and pant. I mean, it's funny. We haven't mentioned this yet. I mean, like one of the things with the lyrical approach to this song was it's very kind of machine gun. It's very sort of precise. It's very dense, should we say. And one of the things with that, to go back, like that's the thing I did all the time in Million Dead. I had a bit of a rep for doing that in Million Dead, of being the guy. It's not quite like rapping per se, but it was very like, and it's very rhythmically specific, and all the rest of it. And I hadn't really done that on any songs in the preceding four solo albums I've made, maybe one or two, but I'd sort of shied away from it as a stylistic approach because I didn't want to be covering the same ground that I covered in my band. And it was sort of around this time that I was really starting to chill out about that kind of thinking. It was like, you know what? Million Dead made two albums. This is my fifth album. Like, I can fucking do what I want, you know? It's like, so I kind of wrote the song in that style with this kind of very, very dense, rhythmic, poetic delivery. And actually, all credit to Rich Costey here, that the one thing we heard back from somebody at the label kind of going, maybe there's too many words in this song. and I was like, fuck you. But of course, thankfully, Rich actually stepped in and said, you're out of your fucking mind. This song has exactly the right number of words.
I mean, there is a lot of words, and that's why I brought up this musical bridge. Not a lot of words in a bad way, but just these 12 seconds. And it almost sounds like some strings come in, or I couldn't tell if they're strings or if they're like an octave guitar pushback.
I'm pretty sure it's a Mellotron strings part.
Okay. It's killer. And it's kind of like a piano solo. The piano's up a couple dB in the mix. It's just kind it's kind of feel good. It's rocking. And then we come into a verse three where it breaks back down. It's just the tambourine and the guitar. And you come back in with, if you could just give me a sign. Yeah, just a subtle little glimmer. Some suggestion that you'd have me if I could only make me better. Then I would stand a little stronger as I walk a little taller all the time. And on the word time here, it sounds like almost, you know how you strum the strings at the headstock of a guitar and it gives that creepy, almost a horror movie sound? Is that what that is?
Yep, that is exactly what that is. Yeah, it's a little...
a little stronger as I walk a little taller all the time. Because I know you are...
Which again, that's Ben's speciality. Ben is the creepy weep noise dude in the band. Like,
it's so
have moments in... Yeah, we have moments in songs where I'm like, this song needs some noise at this point, and I'm not even going to fucking try and do it because I play in a band with the king of guitar noise. So I'm just like, Ben, over to you. And he goes, bing, and it sounds great.
It's so freaking cool, man. I thought that's what that was, but I couldn't really tell if it was a keyboard noise. But it just, again, this song's on an ascent, and this is just another little thing that that adds to it.
Well, that's what I was going to say. So picking that back up again, one of the things that happens here, and everybody's in on this. I think it was kind of my idea to try and work it out, but it was definitely a collective thing with the band. So the bass line, the root notes of the chords in the verse are A, B, C sharp, D. Mm-hmm. And then Tarrant, my bass player, who's a fucking genius, like, and in the second half of this, rather than going back down to the A, goes up to the E. So he keeps going up, right? And then simultaneously, Ben is doing a similar thing. He's going up the scale and up the scale, but at a different kind of rate. So the two of them are kind of two different, it's like kind of waveforms that sort of match every two kind of thing. It's like everyone's kind of building and building and building and building and building until the massive snare drum fill and the high note.
I can't convince you yet, because broken people can get better if they really want to, or at least that's what I have to tell myself if I am hoping to survive.
The Yeah, well, and it's like a rub that works. Sometimes rubs in music don't work. And let me tell you, your bassist is insane. And on that Letterman special, his tone was just killing it.
Oh yeah.
When you guys played on Letterman, it was so awesome. The second half here, the drums, the band is back in. Because I know you are a cynic, but I think I can convince you. Yeah, because broken people can get better if they really want to. Or at least that's what I have to tell myself if I am hoping to survive. And again, here's a build. This survive, you got this long holdout, and then you get high at the end. Again, was that your idea? Was that something Rich? I always...
No, that was my idea. I mean, I have to say, it's a funny old thing. Like, I'm now 39 years old, and I made this record 9 years ago. I made this record. And your vocal range changes as you get older, right?
Yes.
And, like, when I wrote and when we recorded this song, that high A was a piece of piss. It was like, yeah, fucking survive. I'll do it at 7 a.m. I don't give a shit. These days now, it's definitely become a bit of a joke in the band when that bit's coming up, because there's a little breather halfway through that third verse. I tend to turn around to the others and kind of like sort of do this a little bit, cross myself and sort of, let's see how this one's going to go. Because it's not just the high note. It's the high note at the end of quite a long line already, which means that your breathing's already pretty spent out by the time you get there. And it was just like, getting to third. And like, because this song was a big success for me, like, I kept having to play it on, like, breakfast radio shows on tour in America.
The worst.
You've got a hangover. You've got tour voice anyway. It's 7 a.m. and there's no audience to kind of bolster you up. And it's like, cool, now sing a massive long high A. And it was just like, oh,
yeah.
Really?
And you're
much like the song itself. I did this to myself.
Yes. And you're having that moment as a singer and you're going, why did I write that part? Not to mention, you know, you had mentioned something earlier in the episode about talking about these lyrics and having so many of them. Isn't it a grand thing when we write a song like this and then we don't realize how bad of an idea it was till we go to sing it live? And you're like, what the hell did I do?
Oh, yeah, totally. Well, this is why playing songs in live is a good idea, because as we all did before our first album, because that's what you do. You're a band. You play out and then the songs kind of make sense, and then you write a bunch of shit for your second record, start touring it and go, gee, Jesus Christ, what have I done? I'm in the middle of that right now with my forthcoming next record. There's a song which I'm not actually even sure. I kind of wrote it. I'm not even sure if I can sing it once in the studio, let alone whilst playing guitar. So might have to think about that one a little bit.
Well, you know, we get that high note here on Survive, and it just lifts for this last chorus. The high, I'm calling the oohs, ooh. The high ooh vocals are present here in chorus 3. Again, it's a long road up to recovery from here, a long way back to the light, a long road up to recovery from here, a long way to making it right. And then it goes into this outro part. You know, this chorus is never doubled in the song, the main chorus, which is kind of interesting because it's such a catchy chorus. I could see that being repeated, yet you go to an outro here. All three lines are the same here. Darling, sweet lover, won't you help me to recover? And you say that 3 times. And then the very last line is, darling, sweet lover. And then just you a cappella, you end the song. And it just gives this personal touch. Like, again, that singer-songwriter, you're speaking to the listener, speaking to me. And you say, one day this will all be over. It's so killer how it ends, man.
Thank you.
And that outro idea here was that written specifically for the song when you wrote it, or was that something you thought?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the other thing that musically the song does at this point is all of the kind of ascent stuff that I've been talking about, where kind of like, let's say, bass lines or guitar parts run up the scale, have all been over the kind of the verse part where it starts on the A. The chorus part is E to D. Mm-hmm. And thus far, everyone's just been playing E to D. In the outro part, Tarrant essentially does the same thing he does in that third verse on the chorus part. So it starts on E, then he goes to an F sharp, then he goes to a G sharp, then he goes to an A. And it's kind of reconstituted the ascent idea for one more time around in the end section, you know, which again gives it that kind of last bit of kind of blast kind of feeling. And I guess the kind of, I'm not often somebody who will repeat a line that many times in one row kind of thing, but it's supposed to be a plea. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, it's supposed to be desperate. It's supposed to be pleading, I guess would be the word. And interestingly, what that brings up is one of the things about this record, which I don't often remember as much as I should, and I'm remembering now, is that, like, it wasn't just a breakup record written from the point of view of the bad guy. There was definitely an ambivalence within me at the time as to whether or not we might actually get back together at some point and give it another go. And there are parts of this album, and particularly this song, which are very much kind of like, but if you wanted to, you know, go for a drink sometime and see where we're at. That would be cool.
The glimmer of hope in your mind only.
Exactly. She told me to go fuck myself, and so she should have done.
And I love this last line because this could mean so many things, Frank. One day this will all be over. So you're basically saying to the listener, to yourself, that I'm still in this shit here. One day this is going to be over, and that day is not right now, you know? And it also means one day this will all be over. Like, maybe I'll be back together with her.
Right, or maybe we'll be free and clear and not calling each other at 4 o'clock in the morning. And actually, you know, we do, she and I, we chat maybe once a year kind of thing these days, and she's doing well, and there's no bad blood between us at this point, 9 years later. So that's a good thing to be able to say, and we're both happily settled with other people, and hooray for that. But
good for you.
Yeah, there's a kind of ambiguity at the end there, which was intentional. Let me tell you one more story about this song, which I think is worth throwing in here. So we finished song, recorded it, label said this could be first thing. I was like, yeah, sweet, that works for me, and we put it out there, and that was a point in my career where it really felt like I couldn't make any wrong steps. Like, everything I put out, people got really excited about it, and that was really cool. So we'd had this big album, Kick My Bones, what's coming next? Here's Recovery. Everyone went fucking A. But in the time when it first came out, I was in the States, like, because this was a period of my time in my career when everyone was very keen on me being in America all the time because it's a huge market and blah, blah, blah. So we were out in America where my career was not as far along as it was in the UK at the time. In the UK, we were kind of doing large theatres or small arenas kind of thing. Mm-hmm. In the States, we were still kind of doing the grunt work, of which I am proud and which I enjoy doing. Yeah. But so we did like 3 months or something in the States touring, just playing fucking every state, every town, playing to 500 people a night, doing 2 breakfast radio shows, doing an evening in store, really doing the work, you know what I mean? But during this whole period of time, we were out of the UK. Now, the song was big in the UK. I remember a friend of mine texting me and saying that he'd been driving in England, and he'd cycled through 3 radio stations, and that song had been on every single fucking one of them. And he like texted me and was like, I'm so sick of you. Like, why are you doing this to me? But anyway, all of this was kind of academic to me, do you know what I mean? It was sort of happening over there, and we were over here, and that was fine. And it was one of the more kind of the moving moments of my career is we got back to England finally for the UK tour for the album, and the first show was at the Manchester Academy, which is 2,500 people, and it was sold out, and that was cool. And you know, the first third of the set was playing songs from previous records, and that was going well, and everybody was having fun. And then I started playing Recovery, which was the first time we ever played it in the UK, and I knew it had been on the radio, but it was like, I don't know, maybe this, you know how you structure a set list? It's like, well, better pad the new one out with some old favorites just so that people don't lose attention too much or whatever. And so we'd kind of done that, and we got to that song, and I remember playing the opening chords, and the fucking entire room was word perfect on the first verse. And I was just like, what the fuck? And then we got to the first drum fill, and the room exploded like very few times I've ever seen in my life. Like, people were just ricocheting off the walls, the whole room bouncing, whatever. And like, me and Ben, my guitar player, kind of looked at each other and were just like, what the fuck is going on? And like, it was so magical. Do you know what I mean? It was just like, oh shit, this has kind of landed over here. And the next night we rewrote the set list and put it somewhere kind of more appropriate, should we say.
I got goosebumps, man. Man, and I love that story for a number of reasons. I mean, here you were in the interim. You're over in the States slogging it out. You're doing morning radio. You're, as you said, you're putting in the work. You're doing the 500-seat club in Lincoln, Nebraska on a Tuesday night. You know, you're dogging it out. You get back to your home turf. The song blew up in radio while you were gone. And then you're thinking to yourself, you know, I do this. I would put out a new song. You got to put the hits around it, you know, because people are going to take a piss break, go get a fucking beer, you know. And here you launch into Recovery. And I could see the place going berserk because it was at that point a hit.
Yeah, and it was kind of the first time I'd ever really had like a radio hit in my life anyway, because like, I mean, I'd had some radio play before then, don't get me wrong, but it was like, that was my first like all the fucking time daytime radio show song that I ever had in my career. And it was just like, holy shit. It was kind of that thing, I'm sure you know what I'm talking about, we almost fucked the song up, do you know what I mean? Because we were like, what? Like, ha! And like, yeah, just kind of getting a bit freaked out by it. But it was a magical moment, and like, the song will always have an extremely special place in my heart for that reason.
Yeah, no, I saw it on YouTube. You guys played like a tea in the park, and just there's like 60,000 people jumping in unison. It's just such a great feeling. So once again, I just want to thank you for taking the time out for being on the show and breaking this down and congratulations on all your success and continued success.
Thank you, man.
At this point, is there anything you'd like to leave the listeners with any future stuff going on with you and the Sleeping Souls? Are you solo?
I've got we are working on a new record. I have a new drummer these days who's awesome, and the new record's going to be pretty kind of aggressive, would be the word, like in your face punk rock record. Like it's time, do you know what I mean? Like, okay. To do something kind of something aggressive. It'll be out sort of towards the end of next year, but end of this year, I should say. Hopefully. I mean, obviously, who the fuck knows right now? But and I miss the States like you wouldn't believe, and I hope that you and I will share a beer again in the near future.
Well, hey friends, my name is Zach Lupitin. You may know me from the band Dust Bowl Revival, but I also host a music discovery podcast called The Show on the Road. For the last 5 seasons, I've been able to dive deep and have intimate chats with folks like The Lumineers, Andy DeFranco, Wolfpack, Keb Moe, Lake Street Dive, Bela Fleck, and more. So guess what? After 150 conversations with some of my favorite songwriters from around the world, we are bringing brand new episodes to the Osiris Network. New interviews and intimate acoustic performances will be coming at you this summer. And which episodes are coming next, you ask?
I am Zach Goody, the lead singer for the band Smash Mouth.
Our band is called Milky Chance. We are based in Berlin.
My name is David Shaw. I sing and write songs with my band, The Revivalists.
Trust me, these conversations go some wild places. So subscribe to The Show on the Road on Osiris, and we'll see you soon.
As we near the end of the show, here's a band you might not know.
Welcome to this week's Band You Might Not Know. If you'd like your band to be considered for Krista Makes a Podcast, all you have to do is submit your song and bio to bandyoumightnotknow@gmail.com. This week's featured band is Hell's Ditch from Lincoln, England. I chose them today not only because I like their sound, but they were handpicked for Frank Turner's One Foot Before the Other playlist, so I thought it was fitting to include them in this episode. You can find their music on all the streaming services, and here's a snippet of their song, The Likes of Us.
Decisive vindication, a return to bones from dust. And to my surprise, I woke up dead, dead, dead beyond the eyes. And I swear I saw your ghost. I swear I saw your ghost. And to my surprise, I woke up dead, dead, dead beyond the eyes. And I swear I saw your ghost.
The Wrap with Chris and Chris.
Well, I knew before that one started that it was going to be a great one, and I was not wrong.
Yeah, he's quite the conversationalist, Frank is.
People that love Frank Turner absolutely love Frank Turner, and I know why. Everything about him, from his lyrics to the music to the person that he is great. I think that if you were lukewarm on Frank Turner and you listen to this podcast alone, I think you're going to become many times over more of a fan of Frank Turner.
Yeah, you know, when I had met him some years back with Fat Mike, he was just so down to earth, and I was a fan at that point, but my respect level for him just went through the roof with this episode. Just so down to earth, such a great conversation, and the story behind the song was awesome.
And I really like how you turned on your British vocabulary when you got on here. I made a note of all the words you used.
I call them a cheeky twat.
You said twat, you said bloke, you said pint. you really know how to make people feel at home on the podcast.
Well, it's something sure. I didn't get into it with him, and as a lot of the listeners know, Less Than Jake has spent a lot of time in the UK. I've always felt like it's my home away from home, so I've gotten used to the vernacular over the years, but this song has so many English, what's the word? Is it colloquialisms?
Sure.
The first line of the song, blacking out in a strange flat. You know, we don't really call apartments flats here in the States. He talks about a cider in the second verse. Lots of cool little things here, and it was just cool to talk to him.
Speaking of that first line of the song, I really like that he talked about having an amazing opening line of the song to really reel people in right off the bat. I think that's the first person that has brought that up on the podcast, and I thought that was one of my favorite little tidbits of this conversation was him talking about that, because that's a really cool thing to think about when you're going into the songwriting process.
Yeah, and especially as a singer-songwriter and where he's coming with this imagery of telling a story, you got to go for hook, line, and sinker right off the bat, or you know, you're going to lose them by the chorus, and you don't want that.
I love that you talked about them playing on Letterman. You said that was always like a dream to play on Letterman. Dude, I used to, as a kid, tape Letterman every night so I could watch Letterman like as like a 13-year-old. That's how much I like Letterman. So that's really cool that, you know, that he got to do that. I'm sure he doesn't take that for granted. Like, you and I are like in awe of that.
Oh, yeah, know? No. And he even said that that's a big deal to English folks. And I didn't know that. I never really talked to anybody in England about David Letterman or the late night talk shows in general here in the States that are just such a thing that's woven into the fabric of our society. It's a big deal still to play on a late night show that's a good one. But, you know, it's funny, on that Letterman episode, he looked nervous. I don't know if you noticed when he walked up to the mic. He looked, you know, but as soon as he strummed that first chord, it's like just the song took over at that point, and they just kind of, they sounded great on it. It was awesome.
That song has such a giant sing-along chorus. And when he was detailing when he played that song for the first time back in England after the song had blown up, that story about that is amazing. And I can't imagine an entire, you know, packed crowd of people singing that together. Just like you said, it kind of gives you chills thinking about that.
Yeah, you know, I have only really, you know, Less Than Jake never had a real big career radio, but BCN in Boston was playing History of a Boring Town like, you know, two times an hour all day long back in like 98, 99. And we got up there to play a show. And I remember, I think it was what is now the House of Blues. I think it was called the Avalon at the time, like 2,000 people. It was sold out. And we broke in, you know, the rest of the set was great, but when we broke into that song, every person in that audience knew those lyrics. I could totally relate to what he was saying. And it's such a great feeling. It's almost like this extra bit of validation as an artist that just, you know, to know that your song is that accepted by the masses.
There is nothing better in the world as a person in a band or an artist to hear a crowd of people singing words that you wrote.
Yeah.
it's incredible. So, you know, I know you don't even have to really explain. I imagine that everyone from people that have experienced it to people that have sang into a brush in their bedroom in the mirror, just picture that moment of someone screaming your words back at you because they mean that much to them that they want to sing them back at you. And I did think it was funny that Frank talked about, you know, these were self-deprecating lyrics, you know, where he was the bad guy, so he didn't know how to feel about people singing them back at him. And I just one of those, dude, I just smiled through this entire conversation. I thought it was great. I laughed, smiled. It was awesome.
No, it was a lot of fun. The other interesting thing that he said was the label thought that there was too many words, and I thought it was cool that Rich Costey, the producer, stuck him and said, "No, you're friggin' crazy. This is perfect." But it is interesting, and I brought it up, that little musical bridge, I'm calling it the piano solo, is the only 12 seconds in the whole song where there is no lyrics. There is a lot of information in this song, but it works. And again, not an excruciatingly long song. It's only 3.5 minutes, but this song goes by so quickly. And I always say that's testament to great songwriting. It just comes on and it seems like it's over and you want to hear it again.
Hey, sometimes having a lot of words in a song makes it that much more fun when you know them all. if that makes any sense. And I don't think this song really falls into that category, but when you think of songs like It's the End of the World as We Know It or We Didn't Start the Fire, if you know every word to that song, you feel like you really accomplished something and you can't wait to sing along to it. And, you know, to a lesser extent, like, this doesn't have as many lyrics as that, but it's a lot of lyrics. And if you know them, it's even that much more fun to sing along to them.
Yeah, you know, and I brought it up at the top of the episode. I've loved each song that we broke down in the podcast in its own way. And I even have a deeper appreciation for Recovery now. I love this song in a different light than I did even, you know, an hour before we did the episode. It's really cool to be able to analyze them and learn something new and have a different perspective on a song that you've loved for so long.
I love when people are no holds barred about talking what the song is about. Like, yeah, I broke up with this girl. Here's what went down. I was kind of the asshole. I did this weird drug. I did, you know, I love hearing these details. It's honest. It's not like, you know, beating around the bush about what the song's about. I think that's awesome. And I love it when people come on here and are super honest. So props to Frank Turner for that. And also props to Frank Turner for multiple times during the episode dropping Counting Crows, August and Everything After, the first album, because that is my, and I told him this after we were done, that is my all-time favorite album. And I was real happy to hear that it sounds like it's also one of Frank's.
Yeah, and that was really cool of him to not only say that, but then tell us that he's friends with Adam Duritz and that he may be able to put in a little nudge to him to get on the podcast. We're not going to hold you to that, Frank, but it would be awesome.
Yeah, it sure would be. And speaking of the Counting Crows, in their very popular song, Mr. Jones, they actually have a line that says, "Everybody want to pass as cats. We all want to be big, big stars, but we got different reasons for that," which just reminds me of this month's charity.
That's right. This month's charity is the Kitty Corner Cat Rescue and Lounge, located in Everett, Washington. Since their start in 2016, they have saved over 2,000 cats and kittens from high-kill shelters and cared for them until they found their forever homes. Please head over to KristaMakesADifference.com and give whatever you can give. We'd really appreciate it. This is a wonderful organization.
You got to help the cats, man. You got to help the cats. Just go to KristaMakesADifference.com if you got an extra buck or 5 or 10, you're helping out cats. Cats rule. I sleep with two cats on top of me every night, just so you all know. That is the absolute truth. They literally sleep on top of me. I feel like I have a lot in common with cats. And if you feel the same way, or if you just love animals in general, or if you're just a nice person, go to KristaMakesADifference.com. Otherwise, this is a really exciting week for us, man.
It is. There's a couple. There's two other cats that need your help.
Yeah,
that's you and I.
That is true. A couple of cool cats named Chris and Chris, who just happened to make this podcast that you've now enjoyed 46 episodes of, or something like that. A lot of people have asked us, "Hey, man, when are you going to do a Patreon? Or what are you going to have some bonus content?" You know what? We're finally listening, and we are launching our VIP program this week. It's through a site called Supporting Cast. You can go to chrisdemakes.com, and what you're going to get right off the bat, there's a couple different levels, but you're going to get an extra episode every week.
That's right, and we're trying to, we're launching this right now, and we want to hear your ideas as well as this goes along. Please join our Facebook group, Krista Makes a Podcast Facebook group. Join in there, give us your suggestions, and tell us what you want from us in this, because we have a bunch of cool stuff we're rolling out right off the bat. But as you know, we welcome your suggestions.
Yeah, we have a new bonus episode every week. It's called The After Party. There's The After Party, which is every other week, and The After Party Deluxe, where you get an episode every week. But I was pretty excited because, Chris, I asked you to write a theme song for The After Party, and then you sent it to me, and I was like, I always knew the guy from Less Than Jake would one day write a song about our show that we have together. And I feel like, you know, as if people aren't excited enough, I'm sure everyone's just flipping out right now hearing this, but as if you weren't excited enough, I wanted to give everyone a preview of the theme song.
Welcome to the after party. Ready, set, let's go. Welcome to the after party. The show after the show. Learn a little something new. Join us for the ride. Chris and Chris want all of you to know. The after party's where it's at. The show after the show.
Well, Chris, I don't know if it's as good as the Krista Makes a Podcast theme song. Maybe that's the B-side, but I tried my best.
Yeah, dude, it's awesome. And I think everyone's going to enjoy the show. We have a lot of stories to tell. We have a lot of things to talk about. And you're just going to have to check it out. You know, like I said, go to KristaMakes.com. KristaMakesADifference.com. You should go there too. But this is just KristaMakes.com. And you could check out the different levels for the cost of buying us a beer every month. If you enjoy the podcast, you know, we put a lot of time and effort into this, and this is going to allow us to take this podcast even to the next level. And if you like the podcast and you just want to buy us a coffee or a beer per month, that's all it would cost you. And you'll get a lot of extra episodes and a lot of other stuff, too, that we are going to figure out as we go.
That's right. We're going to be launching a bunch of new podcast merchandise. And with the different levels, tiers in the supporting cast group, you'll be able to get discounts on that merchandise. So, again, go over to chrisdemakes.com and check that out. We'd appreciate your support. And speaking of support, please head over to the revamped YouTube page for Less Than Jake. There's a bunch of cool new stuff over there. Head over and check it out. And please hit that subscribe button. We'd really appreciate it.
Love that subscribe click. And love that 5-star review if you want to give our podcast one of those.
That's right. And again, head over to Facebook, join the Krista Makes a Podcast Facebook group. The more, the merrier. We have a lot of fun over there. And I want to thank this week's guest, Frank Turner, for being on the podcast. It was a lot of fun. And we'll see y'all next week.
Hey, this is Steve Choi, host of the Musicians Guild podcast, part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. Within the four walls of the Musicians Guild, we'll be discussing the habits, idiosyncrasies, experiences, and general psychology of my friends and peers all involved with music in various capacities. Listen and subscribe at soundtalentmedia.com.
This is the story of Whitney Houston.
This is the story of Kurt Cobain.
Of George Michael, of Otis Redding, of Amy Winehouse, of Michael Hutchence, Bob Marley. This is the story of Prince.
It's a new podcast series.
About how they died, why they died, and why we're still talking about them so long after.
It's like nothing you've ever heard before.
It's storytelling.
But it's more than that, because rock stars,
they tell us how we feel. They change our mood.
They change the clothes we wear, the people we hang out with,
the way we remember things.
It's them who give us those ludicrous moments, the ones where you're
jumping around, singing your heart out, feeling understood.
And it's those moments we'll help you remember, the ones you're thinking about right now.
That feeling.
That feeling.
It's coming soon from Crowd Network.
Just search for Death of a Rockstar on your podcast app
and subscribe now.